Welcome to the Droma Preventative Health Podcast, hosted by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. We provide you with up-to-date information on health topics geared towards the Orthodox Jewish community. This podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for the medical advice of a physician.
Welcome to the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association, or JOMA, podcast. I'm your host, Elisa Minkin. I'm a general pediatrician and proud JOMA member. And tonight, I'm really, really honored and really excited to be interviewing Dr. Ed Walsh. If there are topics you want to hear, you want to be interviewed, you know someone you want to be interviewed, you have comments about our previous podcast, please reach out to us at health, H-E-A-L-T-H, at joma.org. We want to hear from you. Also, a reminder that this podcast is for informational purposes only. It does not constitute medical advice. Please speak to your own healthcare professional. Dr. Walsh received an undergraduate degree in chemistry from Manhattan College and an MD degree from SUNY Downstate Medical Center in 1974. He completed his residency at the URMC Strong Memorial Hospital in 1977 and a fellowship in infectious diseases in 1982. Since then, he has been a faculty in the Department of Medicine and a member of the Infectious Diseases Division at the University of Rochester. He is the head of the Infectious Disease Unit at Rochester General Hospital, where his clinical activities and research activities are based. And it was a very big honor to interview him. Welcome, Dr. Walsh. Thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Well, you're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm really excited to have you here because I feel like the start of the fall, we have three new products for RSV, which sounds like it's right in time, but it can be confusing, right? It seems like a lot to try to process and sort it out. And so I'm looking forward to helping you sort it out for us.
Right. Well, you're absolutely right. It is a bit overwhelming to a very large extent because things have sort of cascaded rather precipitously in terms of successfully developing the vaccines. Now, in terms of the monoclonal antibody, at least we have 20 years experience with a similar drug, palivizumab, which has been used in very high-risk infants, but for 20 years. So there's just a lot of good safety data, as well as efficacy data showing that it really makes a big difference in these, you know, very high-risk kids, the kids who were extremely premature, you know, 28 weeks or down to 24 weeks. Those are children who would die normally of RSV. I mean, it really is quite awful. But when you give them palivizumab as prophylaxis, it's very effective. And what's new really is that we now have a similar monoclonal antibody, and I say similar because it's not exactly the same, that has a couple of properties that make it feasible to administer it to all infants when they're born, or all infants entering the RSV season who are less than 8 months of age and are at, you know, moderate to high risk of at least disease enough to put them in the hospital. And so this is a long-acting monoclonal antibody, so it hangs around for 5 or 6 months, so it covers the whole season. The palivizumab, which was used previously up until today, is got to be given every month. It's short acting. You sort of get rid of it in about a month. You've lost over half of the antibody that we've given somebody.
Right. I've given it many times to these high risk kids, and it's 5 shots over 5 months, and you have to order it each time and put it together each time.
Yep.
It's not a small thing.
Right, because mom or dad has to bring in the baby, and it's 5 injections. And babies, as they get older and older through that 5 month period, like it less and less.
Right, and they get bigger, and sometimes you have to use a bigger dose.
Right,
sometimes you have to give two needles. It's not a small thing.
Changes. That's exactly right. Whereas with the new longer acting one, you simply have the baby's weight, and you pick one of two doses, and that's what you use. With regard to the vaccines, which really came upon us rather quickly, we've been working on vaccines for RSV since about 1960. And we continue to because there still is a need. We do not have a vaccine for children. There is no currently available, nor will there be in the next couple of months to years, a vaccine for the children themselves. So the approach has been to either give them the antibody, like we've just talked about, or to vaccinate mom. Now,
right. I'm sorry, before we go into all the things about the vaccine, I really want to start with, I'm sorry, I want to start with RSV, because not everybody listening knows about RSV. I want you to really take a little time. I really appreciate this, to explain what is the issues with RSV that we're concerned about to begin with.
Yeah, so RSV, as I said, was identified actually for the first time in 1956. Within a year, it was identified as the predominant cause of severe respiratory disease in young children, especially under 6 months of age. And the it is the number one cause of hospitalization in children. Of any other infection or disease. I mean, it is top of the list of infections that put kids in the hospital. And so for years, this is what we were looking at. And around 1980, 85, and then certainly by 1990, it started to become evident that it wasn't just children who were getting sick, it was adults as well. Now, young adults do very well with this infection. Older adults do not. The disease manifestations are very similar in young infants and older adults. And that is, they wheeze, they cough, they get a low-grade fever, and they get very short of breath, and they can have low oxygen levels. Most young, healthy, vigorous children from about age 5 up through adults about age 60 really have no trouble with this virus. It's a cold. It's a runny nose, a sore throat. And you may feel miserable, and you may feel like somebody ought to do something about it, but you're not going to get that sick. But as you age and your immune system starts to fall apart, as everything else seems to fall apart as you get older, the disease becomes more significant. And there are certain subgroups, just like in children, children who are premature, children who have congenital heart disease or lung disease from, say, prematurity, older adults who have COPD or emphysema, adults with asthma, and very high risk are adults with congestive heart failure. They get into real serious trouble. They end up in the hospital, and some of them die. An interesting fact is that if you look at mortality from RSV in the U.S., the numbers for children is about 50 to 80 a year, which is a very small number. It's kind of on a par with flu, both of which are a bit lower than COVID, by the way. But if you look at people over age 65, the number of deaths in the U.S. is anywhere from 10 to 15,000.
Wow.
So markedly different mortality rates. Yet, if you look at the infection rate, 50% of children are infected in their first winter. So that's half of all the children that first winter. If you look at the attack rate or the prevalence of RSV in the older population, it's only between 2 and 4% a year. So if you're, say, 65 years old, and you may have a couple of grandchildren, your chances of getting RSV are probably no higher than about, 4%. So you have about a 1 in 25 chance of actually getting infected. But if you're a child under 6 months of age, you have about a 1 in 2 chance of becoming infected. And yet, despite these very different attack rates or incident rates of the infection, the disparity in mortality and number of hospitalizations is much greater in the older population. Now, part of that's because we have many, many more older people in the U.S. than we do children under age, say, a year. We have about 4 million births a year in the U.S. The older population keeps expanding, and people live longer, and we certainly have the baby boomers all now turning, 65 or higher, and so we're seeing an increasing number of adults. The illness itself usually starts as a runny nose, sort of a typical runny nose. Nothing's unusual about it. Maybe a scratchy throat, not a severe sore throat, nothing like group A strep. Fever is not uncommon in children, so they will usually have a fever, sometimes usually, you know, 101, 102, maybe even 103. The adult, on the other hand, tends to have either no temperature, no fever, or a very low-grade fever, and that does distinguish it from flu and COVID, which do tend to give you much higher fevers in adults. So, you know, if you have a runny nose and a high fever, you know, you think more in terms of flu or COVID. If you have a runny nose and just a little scratchy throat and no fever, you think of all three, but you got to put RSV in that same pot to say it could be that. The illness is different from flu and different from COVID in that it's very slow to march through. And so you get the runny nose today, you go to bed, and you wake up in the morning and your nose is all stuffed up and your sinuses feel crummy and you have a scratchy throat, but you go to work or you go about your duties. And the next day it's a little worse. And the day after that, you notice a cough. And then on around day 4, 5, or 6, everything seems to fall apart. And this is true with children. I mean, children usually present to the hospital on about day 3 to 4 of their illness. So it's a slow illness to progress. And the same thing's true in adults. The average adult who gets hospitalized usually comes in after about 6 days of their illness, 6 to 7 days, and some even much longer than that. So it sort of wears them out. You know, it's been going on a week or even 10 days, and it's, you know, they're coughing, they're wheezing, they're getting tired, they're not sleeping, and it just wears them out. And the same thing sort of happens in children. You know, about day 4, they haven't been eating because they are all stuffed up and they can't, young children don't mouth breathe, and so they have trouble. If they're feeding, they can't breathe. And so they don't get their nutrition, they don't get their fluids, and they end up in the pediatrician's office and in the hospital. So this is sort of what the disease looks like.
I just want to say one thing, though, that I think that one thing that distinguishes RSV from a lot of the other similar cold-type viruses is that it affects the lower respiratory tract. Yes. When you keep saying wheezing, it really, she needs to be clarified that it's not just your nose is running and you've got a little scratchy throat and a post-nasal drip. And when you see this in a child, you will never forget it. And there is no treatment. There is no treatment.
Well, that's right. There is no therapy. We have made attempts to find treatments for an infected child or an adult too. None of the treatments have been effective, at least not effective enough to make it warranted to actually use them. You know, a pretty typical example is one of my grandchildren who was 7 months of age, not this past July, but the July before, developed exactly this. She developed a runny nose, and my daughter, you know, dismissed it as nothing important. The next day, she continued to have a runny nose. And day 3, she started coughing a lot and kind of acting listless and, you know, not wanting to eat. She was, you know, 7 months of age. She kind of stopped crawling around. And I got a phone call. I was actually in Providence, Rhode Island, and she called me and sent me a video on my iPhone of this extraordinarily listless, non-responsive child. And this was around midnight. And my response was, well, you just get right to the emergency room, where she was admitted to the hospital, and she stayed for 5 days. And so it was sort of that slow buildup over several days. Flu is a little different, because flu, you get that fever right away. The kid really becomes listless right away. And they, you know, you call the doctor almost right away because they have this high fever. RSV is sneaky.
Right. And there is an antiviral. You could do Tamiflu. I mean, putting aside how effective it is and whether you should, you could. There is no antiviral.
That's right. And there have been many attempts going all the way back to 1980. In fact, I was involved in the first clinical trial of aerosolized ribavirin.
I remember it.
When I was a fellow in 1980, working with Karen Hall at the University of Rochester.
Wow.
And, you know, it had marginal benefit. Yeah, you could show that it decreased viral shedding a little bit, but in the long run, it really made minimal difference and certainly not worth the effort to administer a drug, especially something that had, you know, potential side effects and so forth. So
right.
The way to go is either at this point, the options are to address the youngest infants with either maternal immunization or the monoclonal antibody. And they're similar in that they act the same way. So the mm-hmm. idea is this is an antibody. It's a immune functioning protein that you either get from your mom or through the placenta prior to birth and you have when you're born, or you get it after you're born by injecting the child with the monoclonal antibody. And like I said, that's been safely done for over 20 years. The concept of immunizing mom to protect baby is not novel. We do it for flu, we do it for tetanus, we do it for pertussis, and it works. You boost the antibody levels in mom substantially. They are passed along at birth to the baby, and the baby is born with a good dose of the protective antibody. Now, it does wear off about every month. Half of it's gone. So after about 3 to 6 months, most of that antibody has disappeared, and the child is now sort of on their own to develop their own degree of immunity. The monoclonal antibody, on the other hand, what you're doing there is you're giving it at birth, you know, when they're born. And the recommendation by the CDC has been, based on the studies, to give that dose prior to discharge from the hospital of any young child born during the RSV season, to just give them that dose at birth, and then they leave the hospital. If they've been discharged from the hospital, let's say they're born in July or August, and the RSV season may start in Rochester, it starts around Thanksgiving usually. Mm-hmm. In the South, it'll start as early as September. But if you have a child who's, you know, born during the summertime, they're home, they're 4 months old, entering the RSV season, the idea would be bring them into the office and give them the dose there. And again, it's a single dose, so it's nice. And then it lasts for the full season, the full RSV season, which is about 6 months.
I just want to point out that this vaccine is available, but it's not mandatory, because I think some people are afraid when a vaccine is offered to a newborn, they will be forced to take this, and that is not the case.
No, it's not the case.
Right.
nothing related to RSV is mandatory,
right?
Except by daycare centers, where they mandate if your child has RSV, don't bring them to the daycare center because they don't want to spread it.
Right, but they haven't mandated the vaccine there, but they're not going to mandate.
But as far as the vaccine goes, or the monoclonal antibody prophylaxis that could be given instead of the vaccine to the mom, sure, those are totally up to the parents to decide what to do. So as you point out, let's say you are a mom and you are pregnant now. Here it is, October. The RSV season is not upon us yet here in Rochester. We're expecting it to really take off usually around Thanksgiving. So here you are, your mom. You have sort of your due date, let's say, is Christmas, December, you know, right around the first of the year. So you have a couple of options. Option one, obviously, is have the baby, do nothing, and hope for the best as your child, who is now born in the first of the year and has to weather the RSV. Now, they have a 50% chance of getting RSV, at least 50%, through the next, until April, when the virus is gone from the community. So they have a 50-50 chance of getting infected. It's worth parents knowing that 2 of every 100 infants who were born get hospitalized with RSV in the U.S. So
wow,
a 1 in 50 chance.
Whoa, of all children, not high risk.
No, this is all children, 1 out of 50. You know, it's and this is data that is held up statistically year after year after year for, you know, these numbers have been calculated going back 20 years and they haven't changed at all.
See, that's really, really important to know, because you mentioned earlier that the mortality rate for children, thank God, is low.
Well,
and it frustrates me that some people just focus on the mortality rate rather than the morbidity rate. How sick does it make them? Real sick.
Well, you can talk to a lot of moms, and I certainly have, including my daughter,
right,
who's been through this. And it's not hard to find moms who, if you're just sitting around chatting with, you know, five or six women in a room who had a couple of children, maybe they've had, you know, together, collectively you have five moms, collectively they've each had two children, that's 10 children. You'd be amazed at how many will say, oh, yeah, my daughter or my son, yeah, they were hospitalized, and it was scary, you know, and it is scary because the kids can't breathe, they can't eat, you know, and we have good health care, so we get them through, but it is very frightening for the parents. My daughter has PTSD from this, and when she hears that there's RSV, so she now, you know, the kids are in daycare, her older child is in kindergarten. And it, you know, the school sent home notes saying, "Well, there's RSV in the class." You know, so a couple of kids have had RSV. She gets very anxious about that. And I try to tell her, "Well, look, your daughter now is almost
right.
two. She's much stronger. She's healthier. She's already been infected. She has some degree of immunity. She'll be okay." You know, but the parents, it's traumatic. You know, you have your
right.
Very
I mean, I think one thing one thing that's changed is we have a rapid test for RSV that's clinically available in many places.
Yes,
I find it's a double-edged sword.
Yes, you can diagnose it very easy. Just, you know, and people have become very adept and familiar with the concept of swabbing. There's probably not a person in the country who
right.
hasn't had several nose swabs, and that includes children at this point,
right.
Due to the COVID outbreak. And so it's basically a very similar test. You swab the nose and then you send it for a test and you can diagnose RSV. Now, there's not much you can do, as you pointed out, though. Once you're infected, there's not a lot you can do for it other than to be very careful and watch your child and, you know, observe their breathing and how they're doing, because there's not a lot you can do at home for this.
Right. And most kids do fine. You know, that
that's
high rate
exactly
of hospitalization
right.
is because it's so prevalent. It's half the kids get
right.
it.
So if you had 100 kids, 50 would get infected. Two of them would go to the hospital. About six more would go to an emergency room. And about 20 more would go to their doctor. You know, they'd end up in the doctor's office
right.
because they'd be sick enough that mom's worried. Or dad's worried, and so they go there, and then they go home, and they do fine. But that's the healthcare burden and the parents' burden to
right.
deal with, because during that 5 or 6 day illness, somebody doesn't go to work because they're
right.
not going to let them in daycare, and you wouldn't want your child if they were 6 months old and you knew they had RSV, I'm not sure you'd want them in a daycare because you'd be wanting to watch them carefully.
Right. I mean, I think they can't be underscored enough just
right.
how much problems it can give these kids to breathe. It's
right.
not just a matter of missing daycare, you know, missing
right.
work. Not that that's nothing, but.
Right. So going back to the, you know, to the hypothetical woman who's going to have a baby in around the first of the year, option two is to say, all right, I think what I will do is between 32 weeks gestation and 36 weeks gestation, as is recommended by the CDC and the American College of Pediatricians, and the FDA has approved this, I will go and I will have an RSV vaccine, one that's been newly developed for adults, basically. That would include pregnant women. Get that vaccine between 32 weeks gestation and 36 weeks gestation. It's just like what we're doing with Tdap. We're recommending giving Tdap to pregnant women to prevent tetanus and pertussis in their newborns. RSV is not a big problem for a pregnant woman, so we're not really doing anything for that woman. She will be fine if she gets RSV. But what we are doing is we're boosting by about tenfold the amount of antibody that woman will develop over the next 3 to 4 weeks. So if you give it at, say, 36 weeks argon, at 40 weeks, when she delivers that child, the child will have about 10 times the normal amount of antibody. And the studies have been very clear. You have about a 70% to 80% reduction in hospitalization, doctor's visits, emergency room visits, and so forth from RSV over that next 6 month period. So highly effective at reducing the number of infections. So rather than 2 out of every 100 kids ending up in the hospital, you might have 1 in every 300 kids or 400 wow. kids who end up in the hospital. So it's you know, quite effective.
I do want to make a I just want to make a point, though, because I think that we failed with COVID vaccine to explain clearly that this doesn't stop you from getting it.
No.
And it doesn't stop you from getting sick from it.
Right.
And it doesn't stop you from spreading it.
Right.
And so the expectation should be reasonable that we're talking about trying to reduce severe disease right. hospitalization and, with adults right. at least, death and
yes.
for your children.
Respiratory infections. Mm-hmm. Stay limited to your respiratory tree. Your nasal lining cells, your throat lining cells, your trachea lining cells, and your airway cells. Very different than diseases for which we have incredibly good vaccines, like measles. Now, measles doesn't make you sick because it infects your respiratory tree, which it does. It makes you sick because it then gets in your blood.
Right.
And that's why you get that rash. Same thing with chickenpox. Same thing with hepatitis. The hepatitis vaccine actually doesn't prevent you from getting infected with the virus. The virus can still get into your gut and replicate, but it blocks it from getting into your blood and then to your liver. Vaccines that try to prevent respiratory infections can do a pretty good job at preventing the severest consequences like hospitalization, death, you know, severe symptoms. And are much less good at preventing a minor respiratory infection. But that's the point. Turn it into something that's benign.
Right.
Even though you may still get infected. And I think that's correct. There was this enormous misconception about COVID vaccines that they would give you 100% right. total protection from any illness. And they don't. They take you from being potentially dying to being just fine, but you're still going to have some symptoms and you still will be infected and you can still give it to your friend. So that's why you have to stay away from it. So that's option two for mom, is to be vaccinated to protect her child.
Now, how well does that work? I really want to know. I want to compare and contrast because I want to know. I'm sorry. I want to know
right.
why would I choose one versus the other? Since we have two options, which is amazing, yeah. why would I choose one versus the other?
Right. So you can look at the effectiveness of the monoclonal antibody, which is the third option. Mm-hmm. So the option there is mom does nothing until the baby's born, then ask the doctor before discharge, you know, a day or two later, give my baby the monoclonal antibody to protect them from RSV. Okay, the difference in effectiveness is marginal. So you have about 90% to 80% protection with the monoclonal antibody from hospitalization and severe disease, medically attended respiratory problems, and you have about 80% with the vaccine to the mom. Okay, so there's sort of minor differences in terms of you know, how well they work.
Mm-hmm.
The and so it's a real choice. You know, it really is an option that the parents have. You know, one or the other. And I think the best way to put it is there's two good options. Some people might feel more comfortable not giving their baby something and getting it themselves. Some people might feel the reverse. Like I said, we've had 20 years experience giving monoclonal antibodies to young, you know, to very high risk infants without any side effect problems or difficulties. And so, you know, I think it's very safe. Mm-hmm. The vaccines are a bit are new. They're brand new. This is something that, you know, we were fortunate to develop most recently due to some very interesting scientific breakthroughs about how to make a vaccine for RSV and how to be successful at that, since we've been trying for about 60 years. But some very important new scientific information became available from some very good scientists. And the vaccines are tested in, you know, fair numbers of individuals, but they're relatively small.
Like what? So
for instance, most vaccine trials are anywhere from 10 to 30,000 individuals, which is a small number when you really think about, you know, vaccinating, let's say, 60 million people, you know, or 5 million people. You know, it's a much smaller number. So, you know, we need some further time to really get a long-term sense of how effective it may be. We know from the study it's highly effective. There was some minor differences between the placebo group and the women who became immunized, in that there was some increased incidence of premature birth, and not statistically significantly different. So, you know, you can sit down with a statistician and look at the numbers, and they're a little bit different, but they're not statistically different. What does that mean? Hard to say. But if you really looked at it carefully, and this is why the study was done by immunizing women from 24 weeks of their gestation through 36. And what the FDA decided, or the CDC decided, which was a very smart move, they said, well, let's not immunize until 32 weeks. Mm-hmm. Because if you're 24 weeks and there's any risk that it may induce premature labor, that's going to be a problem for that child because they're young.
Right.
But if we wait until 32 weeks, you know, we don't have an issue. There's also the benefit that since you peak in your antibody formation in mom at 4 weeks, why not bring it closer to delivery? And so that's why 32 to 36 weeks. The ACIP and then the FDA accepted this decision, and they decided that it makes sense to make sure that you immunize later in pregnancy, maximizing the benefit of the child and minimizing any potential risk to, say, premature birth.
Right, but I would say, I would say that even 32 weeks, you know, we now know that even a few weeks early makes a difference. So I think you do have to disclose that there is that potential. We don't know how significant, right?
Yeah, it's probably a very, very small risk. I mean, if you look at the numbers, it was somewhere around, say, 4% in one group and 3% in the other.
Right.
You know, a small difference, but it was there. And so you need to mention that. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Right. And if the baby is born prematurely, it takes a certain amount of time, right, to build those antibodies?
No, a baby doesn't make the antibodies. Baby gets it from mom.
Right, so but it takes a certain amount from mom to make the antibodies and transfer it to the baby. It's not immediate.
No,
right?
it takes anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
at a month, they're about tenfold higher. So that infant, when they're born, they have very high levels of protective antibody. I mean, much higher than you would ever see naturally.
Right, but if the baby was born prematurely,
it doesn't transfer.
Right.
That's right. And that's a very important point, that if you were to immunize a 24-week gestation woman and she delivered 4 weeks later at 28 weeks, that baby doesn't get much antibody because most of that antibody doesn't get transferred from mom to baby till late in pregnancy. So transfer of mom's immunity to the baby starts at around 32, 34 weeks, really revs up, and then by 37, 38 weeks, the infant is in fact, and this is somewhat interesting, gets even more immunity than the mom has. In other words,
whoa.
It, you know, think of it this way. If mom has $10 to give the baby. The baby actually gets 11. It's about 10% extra. It's you know, it's obviously a protective phenomenon that has evolved with humans in terms of how do we protect young infants, you know, get as much from mom as you can, and maybe even a little more.
Right, but say you vaccinate it at 34 weeks and the baby's born at 35.
They're not going to get much more.
Right. Right. That would be the time that you would actually, if you wanted to actually give immunity, you would give the monoclonal.
So what would you do then? Let's say that exactly happened. And we've discussed this. This has been discussed in the, you know, in the realm of, well, what are all the potential possibilities? That is, in fact, one. And so will it be a situation, for instance, that you'll have that? Well, certainly, if you have a mom who gets vaccinated 32 weeks and then a week later they have their baby, the recommendation would be, well, give the baby then the monoclonal antibody, because they're just not going to get any boost from mom. And they'll be just like all premature babies and have low levels of immunity.
Right.
You need to give it to them actively with the monoclonal antibody.
Right. And the flip side would be that if the mother did get vaccinated, you don't give the monoclonal later.
Right. You don't give it as long as, say, 3 to 4 weeks has passed.
Mm-hmm.
Before delivery. So if it's
right.
32-week vaccination and you deliver at 37, no, the recommendation would not be to give the baby.
Right. The reason that I'm a pediatrician, so the reason I'm pointing this out is that it's really important to get the records and figure out what happened.
Yes, it is. And it's also one of the reasons why it's complicated.
Right.
And both the obstetrician and the pediatrician and mom and dad all have to understand some of this science. So, you know, it's not so simple as, oh, go to your drugstore and get your flu shot.
Right. What other side effects are we seeing besides injection soreness and swelling from this vaccine to pregnant women specifically?
That's it. Yeah, for the mom, right. Little muscle ache at the site. Maybe a little like nothing different than a flu vaccine.
Mm-hmm. So there's no signals for anything else. I might be thinking,
no.
I know there's two products, right? There's Abrysvo. We've been talking about the Abrysvo RSV
yes,
vaccine.
Yes, we're talking about the Abrysvo, which is the vaccine. Right.
And that is different from the other one, which I can't remember what that name is. There's another one with lots of letters in it that are hard to put together.
Well, then we're moving into the adult group, which is a whole nother story, because there, we don't have the monoclonal antibody. So why don't we use the monoclonal antibody for adults? Well, very simply, cost. It would cost a fortune, because the amount of antibody you have to give is based on the size of the person. So it's about, we didn't mention this, but the use of the monoclonal antibody in the infant is probably going to run anywhere from $390 to $490. Yeah. Depending on insurance issues. And that's based on a dose for a 5 kilogram mm-hmm. or 8 or 10 kilogram kid. And if you've got a 100 kilogram adult, it's totally out of range in terms of price. So you just can't look at that as an option. So the option is cost beneficial option is to vaccinate adults. So we have two vaccines for the adults. We have the same one that we can give mom, that mm-hmm. is from Pfizer. It's the Abrysmo. And then you have GSK's vaccine. And both vaccines are very similar. They contain the same protein, slight difference, but basically the same protein. And the GSK vaccine has a little bit more of a kick to it, and by kick I mean more reactogenicity, sore arm, little maybe low grade temperature, kind of achy. And the reason for that is it has the same adjuvant that's in the Shingrix vaccine, which is so highly effective. And frankly, most older adults are very happy to get. So, you know, I've had the Shingrix vaccine. yeah, it hurts and burns when it goes in because of that adjuvant. And you feel a little achy the next day, kind of the same way you do with COVID vaccines. You may even be achy for 2 days, maybe even have a little low-grade fever. On the other hand, the Pfizer vaccine, which is the same protein, doesn't have an adjuvant. So it's much more like the flu vaccine, you know, a little bit of an achy arm, but nothing that's significant. So they're a little different in that regard, but in terms of their ability to induce immunity and their protective effectiveness, they're identical. So you have about 85% protection from severe RSV in an adult who's been vaccinated.
I'm really confused because I would think if there's an adjuvant, it would make it work better.
And it didn't. Right.
Oh.
It really didn't. It didn't seem to make that difference. Now, we're early on in the use of these vaccines. This is their first year they're out. In the clinical trials, though, there really was no difference. And another not surprising effect, or outcome, but one which we were looking for is how long would the vaccine be effective for? Mm-hmm. Now, flu vaccine, we change every year, which is annoying because the virus changes. RSV doesn't change much. It turns out these vaccines are good for 2 years, at least. The studies, some of them, are actually still ongoing into their third year. But through the first 2 years, the efficacy in the first year was about 85% for severe, preventing severe disease. That is, you know, a bad RSV infection for both these vaccines. In the second season, without giving a booster dose, the effectiveness fell a little bit from 85%, 88% down to about 80%. So a little bit of drop. But not enough to warrant giving another dose. So the current recommendation, until we know more, is for adults who would be at high risk for getting severe disease to really consider going and getting a vaccine. The studies were done in people 60 years and up. But the people who are at highest risk, you know, if you're a 60-year-old and you are healthy, and you're riding your bike to work like I do. Mm-hmm. I'm not 60. I wish I was. But I would not say you should go get your RSV vaccine. I would say, look, if you get RSV, you can have a nasty cold. You might have a bad bronchitis, but you'll get over it. But if you're 75, which is more where I am, then it's not so clear. And you know, it might be worth doing. If you look at what, you know, the U.S. decision was, is talk to your doctor about whether you would be at risk for getting severe disease. A little cumbersome because some people just don't want to have to say, what do you mean I have to call my doctor? Can't I just go to the drugstore and get my vaccine? But they need to, you know, the recommendation from the CDC is talk to your doctor if you have heart failure, if you have COPD, emphysema, if you have other kind of lung disease, if you're a diabetic and you know, have complications of diabetes, you have liver disease, if you're on kidney dialysis, things like that, and you're over age 60, my recommendation would be, yes, the vaccine will be effective for you, but each individual needs to make right. their own decision, as does, you know, and talking to their doctor about that is helpful. And I've certainly been talking to a lot of patients about this. And, you know, I had dinner with a couple of friends of mine who are also physicians who are in the proper age group, some of whom have, you know, conditions that would put them at risk. And, yeah, they were all deciding, yes, I'm going to get my vaccine. One of the questions that always comes up, can I get my flu vaccine and my RSV vaccine at the same time? Can I get my COVID vaccine and my RSV vaccine and my flu vaccine at the same time? And the answer is we don't. Quite know yet. We know we can give flu and COVID together. We can give flu and RSV together. Doesn't affect either one, but we don't know about all three at the same time. And frankly, I'm not sure I want to go into the right. doctor, into the pharmacy and get two shots in one arm and one in the other. I'm spreading them out. I'm, you know, I'll go in. I I've had my COVID vaccine. I'm going to get my RSV vaccine relatively soon now. And then I'll get my flu vaccine as soon as sort of flu starts to creep into our community, which it hasn't done yet.
Do we have any idea? I'm sorry, do we have any idea what a reasonable way to space it would be since we're just guessing?
Probably 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah, something like 2 to 3 weeks. And, it's nice when you're, a physician, especially infectious disease, and you monitor very carefully the laboratory data and you know what's coming along. And I know how many cases of RSV have been in the community or flu have been in the community or other disease or COVID in the community. COVID's on the rise. I went and got my COVID vaccine because I know
Good job.
it's going up. It's going up. I do not want to get it again. So I got that. RSV is not here yet. Flu's not here yet. I have a little time. I can wait. I think probably what will probably come next to Rochester is probably going to be RSV. And so, that's my next one. And then as I keep track of where the flu issues are, and I may change my mind in a week if I see suddenly flu appear on the scene and take off. Yes, I'm going to zip off and get my flu vaccine.
I really like that. I really like that it's nuanced in the sense that, they're saying talk to your doctor, share decision making, and not just saying everybody 60 and up should get this.
Well, yeah, right, and I would agree that it's what my I would have made a different recommendation, and my recommendation would have been if you have a high risk condition, and I would have listed them: COPD, heart failure, diabetes, liver disease, bad kidney disease, especially if dialysis. You should get an RSV vaccine. I don't care how old you are.
That's going to say, what about a 45-year-old who's morbidly,
Well, the studies were done 60 and up, so they're licensed. So you could do it as a physician, but it would be off-label. Doctors can do things like that, give off-label drugs and products. But the current recommendation is if you're 60 and up, you are, the approval is for that. So you could be 60 and have no high-risk conditions, and your doctor can write the order and you can go get it, and it's all under, it's all very legitimate. It's all been approved, FDA approved, et cetera. Insurance company will pay for it. But yeah, I would agree. If you're 50 and you have heart failure, and we've looked at this very carefully. I mean, when we look at who's hospitalized with bad RSV, in the adult field, there's a substantial number of people between the ages of about 40 and 60, represents about 25% of the hospitalized RSV cases. So if you take all the RSV hospitalizations each year, I'll give you an example. Let's say there's 100 people hospitalized in our hospital each winter, which is kind of an underestimate, but let's say it's 100. 75 of them are over 65, but 25 of them are under 65. And why are they there? Well, they have COPD, they have heart failure, they have kidney failure, they're on dialysis, they have really bad diabetes. So they have risk factors. Yet the studies were done 60 and up. That was just the way they did the study. So the FDA has no option but to say, okay, we can license it for 60 and up. Hopefully, there'll be studies done, and there will be, in high risk groups, and we're going to be embarking on one in another group that's really very important. That's immunocompromised individuals were not included in any studies. They weren't included in the original COVID studies either. They weren't included in flu studies. When they tested their flu vaccines. They always come later, and so now it's later. So we've done COVID studies in immunocompromised people. We're now going to be doing RSV studies in immunocompromised people because yes, if you're 40 years old and you've had a bone marrow transplant when you're 35, or you've had a kidney transplant, you're at greater risk for things like flu, COVID, RSV. But we need to do a study and document that it's effective. And so those studies are going to be starting or are ongoing in some instances. And so as we move forward, over the next year or two or three, we'll start to see more and more data. We'll also see more real-world data. You know, studies are interesting. You do studies, they're very, in a sense, contrived. They're very carefully, people are carefully selected. Outcomes are very carefully monitored. People tend to be healthier than the general population that you're really trying to protect. And you really need real world data when once the vaccines are released, licensed, and are in use, then you really get a sense of how truly beneficial they are. Because it's they're a different population, you know. So we will enroll people in a study of, say, an RSV vaccine, and they say they have COPD, and they may very well have COPD, but it's usually going to be mild. Because if it's really bad COPD, they don't feel well enough to enter a study, come to the office to see us, get a screening study, then get vaccinated, then come back in 2 weeks and let us draw some blood on them, then come back in a month and let us draw some blood on them, and then let us follow them all winter, and if they get sick with anything, to come into the office and let us examine them. So the people with COPD or with heart disease who tend to be in these studies tend to be a milder version of it. And so you really don't get a full sense of the impact that it'll have until you really can get out into the general population, and then you'll start to see, you know, benefits that in that sicker population.
Right. What would you say to someone who says, I just want to wait and see what happens in the real world? I'm afraid to get this because I think it's too new.
Well, people will do that. And everybody has the choice here. Like I said, these are not mandated. These are vaccines that have been worked on for decades. They are successful. They work. They seem to have, they have acceptable side effects. And it's up to people to decide what to do.
Do we have the same safety profile for the GSK one, which I can't remember the name of it? Not Abrysvo, it's Abrexi or something?
Yes. Yeah. They like I said, it's a little more reactogenic because it has the adjuvant in it. Mm-hmm. So your arm will hurt a little more. You may have a little low-grade fever. You might feel a little crummy for a day or two. I would argue it's somewhat akin to if you go for your flu vaccine, you get it in one arm. In your other arm, you got that Shingrix vaccine.
Which one it was, right?
More. I
thought there were some signals of possible Guillain-Barré and AFib.
Yes. So in both studies, there were a few cases. There were a total of 3 cases of Guillain-Barré that were, noted. And you don't ignore it. You pay attention. They're not statistically different, because you have very small numbers. So when you look at the placebo group versus the vaccinated group, the numbers aren't large enough to give you a statistical significance. Guillain-Barré is one of those neurologic conditions that has occurred with other vaccines, like flu vaccine. Mm-hmm. There is a very slight increase in Guillain-Barré. The incidence in the general population is quite low. And so it's a little hard, and it's often a diagnosis that is missed sometimes. It's somebody may get weakness in the legs that lasts a week or so, and they really don't ever get fully worked up, and then it gets better, and well, maybe it was Guillain-Barré, but maybe not. So the plan, and the FDA has put in very stringent plans to monitor for Guillain-Barré. And to give you a sort of sense of how this evolves and to show that, we have done pretty well with this. When the COVID vaccines trials were done, and we did the phase one Pfizer trials here in Rochester, and we're following these patients very carefully, and the phase three as well, phase two and phase three. So we did all three phases and were paying a lot of attention to the data. There wasn't a single case of pericarditis in, 30,000 people. And yet, when you now immunized a million, you started to see some cases of pericarditis. And it took about another year to sort out that it was primarily in young, healthy men, between the ages of 18 to 40. And then you started to get the sense, aha, it's somehow related to testosterone levels, because you didn't see it in young women and you didn't see it in children because they're not. So it's, and the mechanism is unclear, but it's pretty clear that in these relatively small studies of 35,000 people or so, with both Moderna and Pfizer's vaccine, adding them up, double that, you didn't see a single case of it.
Right.
Because the incidence is so low.
Right.
And the same thing is with Guillain-Barré. The incidence may be so low, you don't know whether it was just a random event or whether it was a real signal.
I'm sorry, and this was in both vaccines? Both?
Yeah.
It's apparently Arexvi and Abrysvo.
There was one case in the GSK and two cases that were seen in Pfizer. Actually, there was one case of Guillain-Barré in both, and then there was what's known as a variant of it's different than Guillain-Barré syndrome, but it's kind of lumped together as a variant of it. So you had the total of three. And, the idea is that we really need to monitor for that. And so the FDA has made it very clear that they will be monitoring very, very carefully, going forward. So, this is something that people need to be aware of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You want to be transparent about all the potential. Yes, I'm aware of all this data very acutely, and yes, I'm going to go get my RSV vaccine in a couple of weeks. I certainly don't want to have side effects, but my concern is my risk for getting really bad RSV is a lot higher than that.
Right. Right. Well, that's the whole risk-benefit assessment that needs to be made. You need to know all the information, but you still have to say you're not doing nothing is doing something.
Well, right. You I did some sort of back-of-the-envelope calculations that the incidence of Guillain-Barré is X, and the incidence of getting really bad sick with RSV and ending up in the hospital and then possibly even dying is Y, and it turns out that, the chances of that are far greater than the chances of getting Guillain-Barré. And so, you weigh that. You say, okay. But,
right.
Everybody's different. Everybody, everybody's perception of risk is
right.
different.
Right.
I see this all the time with my wife and I. We have very different perspective of activities and risk. It's human nature.
Right.
There are people who, have blind faith in what their doctor says to do. Good doctor says go do this, and they just go do this. And then you have others who will want to see evidence for everything their doctor says.
Right. Maybe not even back of the envelope. Maybe the front of the envelope.
Right. And they will come to the doctor with 18 pages of literature they've gotten off the internet. And others just say, tell me what to do, doc, and they go do it. So, you've got people are very different.
Right. Right. I have to thank you. This has been so amazing. You've been so honest and transparent and informative, and I just really appreciate it so, so much.
Well, I hope it's useful.
No, I really think it is. There's a lot to process. There really, really is.
It is a lot. And, I think for all of these, I think I wouldn't say the toughest, but I think the major pressing issue is with the pediatric situation, where you have such a great opportunity to cut down the number of RSV infections, hospitalizations in the U.S. And we didn't even mention that there may very well be a relationship between severe RSV or even mild or even moderate RSV in childhood and asthma.
Right.
And
that's true.
We will find out if once these vaccine and or monoclonal antibodies are being given, reducing moderate and severe RSV, we will be very, very carefully looking to see is the incidence of asthma drop. Because that, if that linkage turns out to be accurate, that's going to be a huge benefit. That if
right.
You know, I was born in September, going into the RSV season, obviously, in 1948. And I was sick a lot as a kid, and I was never hospitalized, but I developed asthma by about age 6 or 7 and had pretty bad asthma till I, you know, became an adult. Never want to go back to that. And it's quite possible that I had RSV as a little kid that was, you know, moderate, didn't put me in a hospital, and then and subsequently developed asthma. And we see that a lot. Whether blocking the RSV infection in young childhood prevents that asthma, though, if that turns out to be true, that will be a huge effect and benefit. Massive.
Right. It'd be a major game changer. But we first have to get there. We first have to make sure that this
we
is
did.
Affordable, accessible, and people trust.
Right.
Right.
Yep.
So
All
thank
right.
you.
Well, it was great talking to you.
Really appreciate it. Be
Good
well. Good luck with the RSV vaccine.
Okay. Bye now.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks for listening to the JOMA Preventative Health Podcast. If you've enjoyed this, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this with your friends. For more information, check out our Instagram at JOMA_org. Check out our website, www.joma.org, that's JOWMA.org, or email us at health@joma.org.